Welcome to the world of peace, love, and homicide, brought to you by the Broadcast and Communications Department of Dominican University. I'm your host, Bloody Cowboy, and we will be delving into the many distinguishing features of America in the 70s and 80s, particularly the prevalent serial killing. What was it about that time period that inspired over 1,000 mentally ill people to murder in such an abominable manner? What motivated serial killers like Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer to commit such atrocities? Why has this trend of serial murder declined in our day and age? I'll give my response to all those questions and more on this session of Peace, Love, and Homicide. Welcome back to the wonderful world of Peace, Love, and Homicide. We are sadly approaching the end of our semester. Our podcast will be coming to an end. I know, I'm sad, I'm really sad, but I've had a great time talking to you, and I hope you've had a good time listening. Our newest dark tale, and our last dark tale, is about Charles Manson and his family, which formed during the Summer of Love in 67, but ended with the brutal murders of Sharon Tate, Leno, and Rosemary LaBlanca, and four others. I know it's not technically the 70s, but they were killing until 1970, and he was convicted in 71, so y'all know that I like to stray away from the topic anyways, like, just a little bit. I don't stick on 70s and 80s all the time. But anyways, point is, it happened in the 70s. So, it happened in the 70s. Alright. So, honestly, this case is especially significant for me because Charles Manson was in prison and died at the San Quentin State Prison, which is located near my home. Manson moved to Berkeley in the mid-60s and then San Francisco, cities that were overrun with young people seeking a new way of life. He amassed a small group of followers, almost entirely women, and in 1968, he headed to Los Angeles with several female followers in order to pursue a music career, having learned to play guitar in prison. Manson's tools of persuasion were the late 1960s lax social codes, in which runaway hippies mixed freely with Hollywood royalty, and his ability to tell others what they wanted to hear, both of which he used to form a friendship with Dennis Wilson, the Beach Boys drummer. Manson had ties to a number of wealthy and powerful people in Los Angeles. He met record producer Terry Melcher, the son of actress Doris Day, and he was a boyfriend of the model and actress Candace Bergen. At one point, Angela Lansbury's daughter was a family hanger-on. Although she wasn't an official member, she used her mother's credit cards to buy food and clothing for the family. The Manson girls, as they became known, towered almost as large in the public imagination as Manson himself. Manson family members, mostly young women in their late teens and early 20s, were not uncommon in the late 1960s. White, middle-aged women from all over the country were flocking to cities like San Francisco and LA, influenced by other hippies' desire to turn on, tune in, and drop out. Manson used his female followers to entice other men to both join and support the group. It was several of the women who first met Dennis Wilson and brought Manson to his home. Diane Lake, a Manson follower who was only 14 when she met Manson, described long nights of lectures in which Manson instructed the others at the ranch to take LSD and listen to him preach about humanity's past, present, and future. But none of that compares to the fact that he compelled them to torture and kill for the sake of his sick and twisted mind and ego. Even if you don't know much about old Hollywood, you've probably heard about Sharon Tate. On August 8, 1969, at the age of 26 and about 8.5 months pregnant, four people broke into her home at 10500 Cielo Drive in Beverly Hills, a house their cult leader, Charles Manson, had previously visited as a guest and killed everyone inside. Manson directed his followers to a different address in central Los Angeles, this time owned by a middle-class couple, Leno and Rosemary LaBlanca, to kill again the next night, desperate to make their first round of deaths appear to be a race war. The Tate-LaBlanca murders had a profound impact on America's perception on itself. They appended notions of safety, security, and innocence, effectively killing off the 1960s counterculture counterculture and ushering in a new decade of dark, dark psychosexual, conspiracy-laced cultural exploration of America's seedy dark side. The ritualistic nature of the killings paved the way for the emergence of satanic panic, a phenomenon that never completely vanished. However, you may be surprised to learn that Manson's followers had both killed before and after their most famous murders. The cultural narrative surrounding the Tate-LaBianca murders is that they occurred out of nowhere, that Manson's followers simply erupted into unthinkable violence on command after being thoroughly brainwashed. However, by the time he moved to California, Manson was a career criminal, and the Tate-LaBianca murders were part of a long period of escalating criminality from him and his followers. Another long-held public perception of the Manson family murders is that they were kind of a psychic attack on America itself, an explosive release of tension, an unavoidable result of the 1960s freewheeling, drug-crazed counterculture. Countless depictions of the murders in the 50 years since they've occurred have largely framed them as a drug-fueled, randomized frenzy. But as many discovered through a deep dive in the Manson books, trial transcripts, and archival media reports, the murders were neither random nor reactionary backlash to normative American culture. Rather, they were an outgrowth of Manson's warped sense that he was entitled to all the power and fortune that he desired. Manson also allegedly ordered his followers to commit the Tate-LaBianca murders in order to kickstart what he claimed would be a coming race war between the government and black citizens, particularly the Black Panthers, whom he despised, of course. Manson dubbed this movement Helter Skelter, claiming that the Beatles' White Album song of the same name, written about an amusement park, was foreshadowing the impending war that he wanted to create. Throughout the summer of 1969, Manson teased his followers that if black Americans didn't start Helter Skelter, that his followers would. His family, per se. However, Manson also wished to divert attention away from his other crimes. After a disagreement over a drug payment, he shot a drug dealer named Bernard Lotsapapa Crow. In May 1969, Manson had urged several of his followers 2 months later to steal money from a friend of his named Gary Hinman. Bobby Boussoulet, a Manson follower, killed Hinman after 2 days of holding him hostage, during which Manson cut Hinman's ear. Members of Hinman's family attempted to blame his death on the Black Panthers by writing "Political Piggy," a Black Panther symbol, in blood on the wall. Boussoulet, on the other hand, was arrested for the murder and taken into custody on August 6th, thank God. In conclusion, on January 25th, 1971, Charles Manson and his 3 followers were found guilty of the murders of Tate and LaBianca and the 4 others that he killed, or that they killed. The killers were initially sentenced to death, but California later abolished it, so that reduced their sentences to life in prison. However, being in prison did not eliminate the threat posed by Manson's mayhem. His followers continued to believe in his helter-skelter message and attempted to impress him with their own violent acts. And even 50 years after the murders and 2 years after his death in 2017, Manson continues to loom large in cultural imagination. Pop culture is ripe with depictions of him. In his latest film, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Quentin Tarantino returns to the subject of the murders. But I might add that that movie is really good, so I'm not complaining. But it is kind of interesting to be like, why are we thinking so hard about it? Why are we giving him so much attention? The attention that he wanted, the stardom that he wanted. I mean, technically I'm giving him that by talking about this, but not what I'm trying to do. Anyway. Point is, I have a very special place in my brain for the Manson family murders, and I really wish that we had more time on this podcast so I could tell you about all the other things that I really am interested in, and that's okay, it's all good, because I will see you again someday, or you will hear me again someday, hopefully. Thank you so much, whoever's out there, for tuning in to Peace, Love, and Homicide. We'll be right back.